This is an SBC Media Partners production.
Swung on, hit high and deep, right field, third
field, third field. It is high here.
Phillies fans, these are your Glove Stories with Murph.
Check in with Greg Murphy. Murphy, you got a special guest, huh?
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Glove Stories with Murph, presented by the Parx Casino Sportsbook app and the great folks at Red Robin. And it is really great to welcome in our guest today, who has one of the most interesting baseball stories to tell. And Phillies fans, you certainly know him for a lot of different reasons, and that's part of what makes his story so special. And we're going to get to all of that today. It is a real pleasure to welcome in Ruben Amaro Jr. to the show. Ruben, thanks for being here. I'm excited to hear some of your Glove stories because, you know, you talk about a baseball life. Yours is a baseball life. You're a baseball lifer, right?
Yeah, that's great to be with you, Murph, and honored to join your podcast here. I mean, to me, you're right. Baseball's been my life from Jump Street, you know, my dad having been involved in it. And in so many different ways, and then me kind of following in his footsteps in some regard. But it's been a fun one, and I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Well, and there's lots more to still unfold going forward. We know that, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But I guess for you, and this is a question I have not asked anybody else, I don't think, on the program yet, but I'm going to ask you to start. What is your first memory of baseball? I mean, because I would imagine it was pretty early in life.
Yeah, actually, when I think back, I actually very, very faintly remember, and I must have been an infant, but I faintly remember being in my mom's arms and seeing a lot of red. And so I was very, very young when I was born in 65. My dad was still with the Phillies at the time. I don't have any like real clear ones other than the ones that when I was a little bit older and my dad was playing for the California Angels at the time. You know, my biggest thing, I think I was probably around 4 or 5 years old at that time. The coolest thing about being around baseball was that I got to be at Disneyland all the time because my dad was in Anaheim, and we got like free tickets to go to Disneyland and Knott's Berry Farm and those kind of places. And so my dad was playing in summertime. We were living in Orange County in California, and here we are, my brother and I, going to Disneyland every weekend. So that was kind of cool.
So, this baseball thing's all right.
I don't mind this baseball stuff. My dad's not around a lot, but
right.
It's okay. I can still jump on Pirates of Caribbean anytime I want.
That's great. So obviously you start playing the game at an early age, and not just baseball. I know you played soccer as well, you know, probably other sports along the way, but when did baseball, was it always your first love? Was it always the game that you kind of gravitated back to?
That's funny you should say that, because really soccer was. I mean, the very first sport that I played that was an organized sport in Little League, so to speak, was mm-hmm. soccer. I ended up having a real good friend in my grade school from Frankfurt Friends School, a guy named Pat McMenamin, and Pat invited me over for a sleepover one day, and he said, "Hey, man, I got to practice." And I was there I was at Gibbons Powell like the next, you know, that afternoon after I got back to school, came back to school with him, and practicing one of his games. I guess they had a scrimmage, and I scored like 7 or 8 goals. And the coach calls my mom and says, "Mrs. Amaro, we'd like to have your son on our team." So that was like my very first memory of like playing sports. And I played for Gibbons Powell in a number of areas. I started with soccer, and then I played a little bit of baseball there. But then I joined an organization called Crispin Gardens, which is in the Northeast Philly. And really, that's when baseball started for me. Started off as a peewee. I was mm-hmm. playing a couple of years ahead. And I think I was probably 9 years old. I was playing in a team that probably was mostly 10 and 11 year olds. And my brother was playing up. We also played. And, you know, I was always chasing my brother. My brother, David, was always kind of, his friends were my friends. I was always kind of trying to be, you know, the big boy, because my brother was, you know, he was a little bit more advanced, 2.5 or so years older than me. So I was always kind of chasing him and playing up and doing that sort of stuff. But, But yeah, it was soccer first and then baseball. And then I ended up playing basketball and tennis and swimming and a bunch of other stuff. But I don't think it was until, really, honestly, it was until I became a bat boy in Philadelphia. My dad was involved in the organization as in a lot of different roles, but he was became a coach. And I started working for Kenny Bush in the clubhouse and then became a bat boy and went age 15, 16, 17 years old. And that's when baseball became my real love.
Okay. But obviously you were an accomplished player at that point, you know, at the high school level and that kind of thing, right?
Yeah. And I started, you know, I played high school ball and soccer and actually probably a better soccer player than I was a high school baseball player. But I think just being around the clubhouse and being around, you know, the Mike Schmidts and the Larry Boas and Manny Trios and Bob Boones. I mean, you can go on and on and on, those great late 70s, early 80s teams. And then, you know, getting to meet guys like Gary Matthews and Steve Carlton and just being around them almost all the time. I mean, I thought to myself, man, not only is this game like fun, but, you know, you can make some money doing this too.
Yeah. Hey, that's a pretty nice car he's driving over there.
Yeah. You know, and then, and, you know, I got to, then I saw, you know, a bunch of stuff about Pete Rose and got to meet him. And, you know, my dad was, you know, now in the part of the coaching staff. And it became one of those things that, you know, that the fantasy started to become something that I wanted to make a reality and ended up going and playing off, you know, playing baseball at Stanford and et cetera, et cetera. But it was really the impetus behind me, like wanting to play baseball, was just being around and being in the clubhouse with all those guys for so many years.
I've heard that from so many different folks that, you know, have a connection to baseball before they have their connection to baseball, similar to your story. And, you know, just the idea, you know, talking to Mr. Giles a couple weeks back and how he grew up in a clubhouse, you know, just that idea that, wow, you know, I can be around this game and I can make this my livelihood. I can make it my life. You know, it clicks early, I think, for folks that like yourself who obviously were accomplished in the game, but also saw that this is a great way to make a living. This is a great way to spend your time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're right about that. But I think you also develop like a connection with the game in a totally different way than maybe others would, because you really, it becomes more of a lifestyle. It becomes a love. You know, you have I truly love the game of baseball because I grew up around it. I've seen so many good things, so many like not so good things. I've had an opportunity to just be around some phenomenal baseball people and some not so phenomenal baseball people. And just to understand and to be able to be around it and to just to make it, for me, it wasn't really a job. It became like a lifestyle and a career. It's really, really different in that regard for me. And it started as a kid. It really started as a kid and watching my dad, you know, do his thing and spend time, you know. It's funny because you think about it, all the time that my dad spent away from the house, he must have really, really loved the game of baseball to have spent so much time away from home. I knew he loved his family, but it was also something that, you know, this guy, you know, he must really have something truly invested in this to spend so much time doing it. Mm-hmm. And he must really love this thing, because otherwise people just wouldn't, if people in baseball got paid by the hour, they'd be bazillionaires.
That's the truth.
And you learn that along the way, if you really want to be good at it. I mean, it's all about, you know, spending time and making the effort. And it's anybody who spends that much time doing this, they must really love it.
You know, it's a really interesting perspective to have about your father. You know, I think that do you remember when that kind of clicked with you? Was it in your teenage years that you said you made that connection between how much he must really love it to sacrifice the other stuff be there for that?
Yeah, you know, I had a conversation with my mom, my grandma, who was my mother's mother, and obviously my maternal mom, a grandmother. She, you know, she said, you know, are you going to get into baseball too? I think I was like 14 or 15 years old. I said, well, I don't know if I'm going to be. She said, well, if you do, you're going to have to be committed because it's going to take a lot of time away from your home. It's going to be tough for your family life and stuff like that. And I think that's when it started to dawn on me, oh my God. You know, my dad must really, really love this because I know he loves us. I know he loves my mom, but, you know, he's got to spend a lot of time away from us. And so there must be some difficulty in this. And surely, you know, listen, I miss my dad a lot. He was away, you know, he was away probably half the month when he was doing the Caribbean stuff. He was actually one of the very first, I guess, Latin American coordinators for the Phillies ever. And so he started to develop where he signed, you know, the guys that ended up being pretty famous, Juan Samuel and Julio Franco and George Bell and guys like that. My dad brought into the organization, which I'm really proud of. But I mean, it took a lot of work to do that, man. It's hours and hours and hours in other countries trying to formulate, you know, relationships, trying to sign guys, trying to develop, you know, relationships with scouts and such and such. You have to be committed to doing it. And that certainly was something I learned fairly early.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know what? You learn that work ethic and commitment, which later in life is going to benefit you and would benefit anybody when you sit there. And I don't want to get too far away from this before I ask you this. So another thing that kind of shapes all of us is where we grow up. And you grew up here in Philadelphia, like me, you know, outside of Philadelphia, me, you in Philly. And just how important do you think that has been? Because you are Philadelphia, you know, that's your genesis. That's where you come from. And I think that's an important part of what makes us who we are.
Yeah. So my dad took root with my mom, Judy, in Philadelphia after he was traded from St. Louis to Philadelphia. My dad met my mom here. He made his roots here, and we ended up living in Northeast Philadelphia in the Ronhurst section, and that's where I grew up. So I was Philly born and bred. Didn't know anything else. Really. I mean, obviously got opportunities to travel and do a lot of other things over the course of my lifetime, but this was home and always was. And even was when I went to college, even was when I ended up playing with the California Angels myself. Anytime, it's always home base for me. I always came back here and I've never really left here. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I meet people in the streets. So it's great to have you back. I said, I never left.
Yeah.
You know? I've never gone anywhere. I mean, I've gone to other organizations. I went to Boston and, you know, New York and such. But this has always been my home. I made my home here, got married here, had my kids here, the whole nine yards. So the fact that I get to do what I do now as far as being on the air and broadcast radio and stuff like that is really kind of full circle for me. I never want to leave. I didn't ever want to get fired as a GM, obviously, but things happen. And, you know, but, you know, that the fact that Philadelphia, I was Philadelphia born and bred, and that my dad worked for the organization for 40 years or whatever, you know, I've never thought of myself other than a Philly, even though I was getting paychecks from other places, which is important. You know, this has always been home.
Yeah. Yeah, I get it. Obviously, I get that. I feel very similar in a similar situation, albeit a different career path. All right, so high school, William Penn, 83 to 87, and then '83-'87 college, right, at Stanford.
Yeah,
you graduated in '87 from Stanford. Part of a national championship team there, which maybe a lot of people don't know. I mean, obviously the Stanford University, amazing school, great athletics as well, really probably the best of both worlds. But you guys were a pretty darn good team, win it all in 87.
Yeah, I mean, my decision came directly from a guy named Joe Perot. The reason that I went to Stanford, I mean, he basically challenged me because I had opportunities to go to schools, Princeton, Duke, Vanderbilt, and Stanford was like, you know, another show. Lafayette also, which was an area school. I had opportunities to stay here and play baseball, and probably, you know, I was not a super high recruit, but there were some, you know, schools that, because of my academics and because of my athleticism, and I guess the fact that my, you know, my dad, you know, some of my genetics, I guess I had an opportunity to get a couple of scholarship offers. But I didn't think for a minute, actually, that I was going to, you know, be like a star or be able to play much at Stanford. But when I went out there on my recruiting trip, man, I was like, oh, my God, I have to go here. I mean, this place is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I was kind of this close to going to Princeton or Vanderbilt. I think Vanderbilt was my second choice. But, you know, when I saw that place, I said, almost immediately I stayed there. And believe it or not, it was raining of all things. It was raining for most of my recruiting. But then it like the day I was leaving from my recruiting trip, the sun came out. I was like, oh, you know,
perfect.
This is what you have to do. So I signed my letter of intent. I called my mom and said, I'm going to Stanford, Mom. And she's like, what? You're going to the other end of the world? She was not, I don't think she was prepared for that. But it was one of the best, if not the best decisions I've ever made.
Tell me a little bit about that 87 championship team, because, you know, winning a national championship in college, I mean, obviously winning a World Series in baseball, winning a Super Bowl, the greatest achievements for sports, but in college, that age with like-minded guys around you, that had to be a blast as you guys went through the 87 season and end up in the postseason and winning it all.
Yeah, pretty spectacular. We had gone, you know, the tradition at Stanford was that at that point they had started to build kind of a franchise type of a program there, where it became a pretty good one. And they, you know, they were striving to get to the World Series and win it, had not won it yet. Mark Marquess was the coach. He's a Hall of Fame coach, had, I don't know how many bazillion wins, but and we called him nine. That was his number nine. So when I got recruited there, the expectation was that we were going to find out in those years that I was going to be there, we were going to get to the World College World Series. That was the goal, and to win it. And that's all we thought about. And my first year, my freshman year, got a chance to play quite a bit as a DH, which was an amazing opportunity for me. We got to the regionals, got knocked out early. My second year, my sophomore year, we had a phenomenal team. A couple of the major leaguers, or one of the major leaguers, I guess, Jeff Ballard, who was a left-handed pitcher, was our number one starter. Pete Stanisek was a second baseman, the outfielder for the Baltimore Orioles. There were some other guys who got like to AAA and did okay. Rick Lundblade and some others, some All-Americans. Rick Lundblade actually got drafted by and signed by the Phillies. He was a catcher, first baseman. Anyway. We were ranked number one. We had an unbelievable season. I think we were like 57-13, some ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, we crushed, and we had some really, really talented guys. Another guy named Mark Davis, who ended up getting to the major leagues. Mike Davis's brother, an outfielder. But we go in ranked number one in the country. And, you know, the top eight teams, you know, they play, you know, round robin or whatever it is. And, you know, if you win games, you stay in the winner's bracket. You lose a game, you go into the loser's bracket. We got knocked out in like two games. I was playing third base my sophomore year and wasn't a very good third baseman, but I could swing the bat a little bit. But they used to take me out for defense because I stunk. But anyway, we got knocked out pretty quickly. And that was kind of a shocker because we went in number one and then we ended up getting knocked out by like the number eight seed. I think it was Miami. We just got beat up, and it was unfortunate, but the goal from that point on was then, you know, not just to try to make a name for yourself, but I mean, the next goal was to try to get, not just get there, but to win it. And so in 87, I ended up playing for a team that had guys like Jack McDowell as our number one. We used to call him Black Jack. Great competitor. We had Ed Sprague, who was a third baseman, who was had an outstanding yeah. Two guys who have made excellent major league careers. Toy Cook, who was in like an all-pro D-back, also played center field for us, and he got drafted by the by, I think he got drafted by the Minnesota, I want to say he got drafted by the Minnesota Twins at some point. But we had some really good play. I ended up playing left field. They moved me to the outfield at that point and was a preseason. I was a preseason All-American, ended up being a second team All-American that year, had a very good year that year. David Esker was a shortstop who is now the head coach at Stanford. So Ron Whitmire played for the A's. And we had a bunch of guys who actually got to the big leagues. And so we had a pretty darn good pitching staff. And we just gelled, man. It was unbelievable. My senior year, I remember one of the biggest things I think had happened for us was we gelled so well together. It was kind of like an old school team. I was like a member of a different fraternity. I was a Theta Delta. And then when I became a senior and kind of one of the captains of the team, I decided to move into the baseball frat, which baseball house, which is Delta. And I, as a, you know, as a boarder, I just decided, you know what I'm going to do? I think to bring it all together and get us all together, let's just hang out and we'll hang out together. We'll have a few adult beverages together. We'll try to bond a little bit. And we just became a family that was amazing. And so we brought in the freshman, and Paul Carey was like a freshman of the year that year, ended up having an unbelievable, World Series for us, was hitting fourth. I mean, we ended up having like a camaraderie that was built that I think it reminds me a little bit of what it was like to be on the 93 team, where you just had a bunch of guys who loved to be around each other, didn't all necessarily love each other, but when we stepped on the field together, it was like magical. You know, we try to figure out ways to beat the other team, and being a part of that, and ended up, it was a real unlikely, we were going through the loser's bracket, and Paul Carey gets a big home run against LSU to win an extra inning game. And it was like, oh my God, we're destined to win this damn thing. And, Jack McDowell ends up winning, decisive game in the World Series against OSU. And I think Robin Ventura was the best hitter on the planet. Yep. We ended up, beating their team. And it was just, it was a spectacular moment. And they kind of followed it up after that. They won it again in 1988. So we won it in 87. I graduated, Jack signed, a bunch of guys left, but the core, there's still a young core of that team. They came back and did the same thing the next year and won back-to-back World Series, which was amazing. I mean, they just had the it factor, they just figured out a way to win baseball games. I think Ed Sprague was a big part of it. Even as a young player, he was a presence on the team, and it was just cool because we had a lot of guys who just wanted to win baseball games, and you get enough guys wanting to do that. And you definitely had that in that 93 team, as I referenced before. You get enough guys to do that on one team and then have enough talent. You obviously have to have the talent to do it. It can be really magical, and it was for us.
Yeah, it's an interesting parallel with the 93 team, because a lot of the things you're saying are things that we hear your teammates from 93 saying all the time about about that particular year and how special it was. We'll get to that in a second. Before we leave the formative years, 85, you're in Cape Cod playing in the Premier Wooden Bat League. And I've heard great stories out of the Cape Cod League. I can't get the image of Mickey Morandini as a shirtless house painter out of my head, where he would paint the houses during the day and play baseball at night. What a similar experience for you? I mean, it must have been the best time, right?
So I was a houseboy one year, and that So I ended up going, there was a very affluent woman who owned this home on the Cape, and I played for Kituit, and that was a blast too. I mean, I ended up playing with some unbelievable major league players. Greg Vaughn was our center fielder. I mean, Brian Hickerson, Chris Carpenter. I mean, we had major leaguers guys who played major league baseball all over the place, and guys who got to the AAA and didn't quite get to the big leagues. But we had some really, really good, Derek Lilliquist played on our team. So we had a whole slew of guys who were major leaguers. We ended up winning the championship one year, but even Ed Sprague played with me one year, but I was the house boy. So my job And every single day was to, they had a home that was like embedded in kind of in the woods, and they had a huge deck. And, you know, I grew up in like, you know, a kind of middle America. I grew up in a duplex, and I had never seen houses this like grandiose, right? So here I am, like every single morning, like the first part of my day, I would come in, have to sweep the deck of all the leaves. You know, it was like, I don't know how many square feet that I had to do that. And then I did some painting, and then I did some pruning, and I was doing all types of stuff just around the house, just to clean up the house. And I got paid, you know, an hourly wage, whatever it was, a minimum to do that. So that was an interesting one. That was a little tougher than my next year's job, which was actually because I graduated, I got to come back another year. So they gave me the cushy job. So I got to do the clinic, baseball clinics for the kids.
Yeah,
that's was a blast. I did that actually with Ed Sprague, and he and I just we just did, you know, for kids anywhere from age, I think the cutoff was like 7 or 8 years old to like 12 or 13. And we got kids in the area, and they came like every morning on our home games, and we did a clinic, and it was just, you know, teaching them like the basics of baseball. And that was so cool. I mean, that was really, really, really cool. And the neat thing about doing that was that you could like almost immediately see like which kids were like really athletic, even at a young age,
sure,
just by the way they handled their glove and how they could catch them. One of the toughest things to do, if people don't know this, is to actually be able to have the eye hand coordination to catch a ball, like with your glove, you know, to be able to use your hand with a dexterity that's different from other athletes, and be able to gauge like when the ball's coming and when to catch it, and to have that kind of eye hand coordination. And it was so cool to watch like some of these young kids like get better and better and better. I actually still had relationships with some of the people who I had did the clinics with, and that's pretty cool. I mean, yeah. I've known these people for, you know, 30 some years now, 40 something years almost now, and to still have those relationships. It was a great experience in the Cape. And luckily for me, I got to do it 2 years.
You know, listening to the guys talk about the Cape Cod League, it sounds, I mean, we've all seen the movie, and that's all fine and good. But you know, if you love baseball and if you aspire to be a professional ball player, going through the Cape Cod League is a special experience. But it sounded like a blast too, to be a young person, you're almost like a celebrity in town at that point.
It's really cool. And actually the year that I started was the first year they did wooden bats. So it became a wooden bat league. That was the first time. And I thought that would be a great experience for me. My dad was like all in, like, yeah. Grab a wooden bat, get the feel for it, because it's way different. And that was a great exposure for me and a great learning experience.
Yeah. All right. So you get drafted by the California Angels in the 11th round. You make your way through the minor leagues, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time in the minors, but I went back and was looking at your numbers in the minor leagues. Man, oh man, you raked in the minor leagues. I mean, you moved through pretty quickly, obviously, because you were hitting the ball so well. I mean, you had a feel like, all right, I got this thing locked down, right?
Yeah, so I studied hitting a lot. It was like one of these project things for me. And I knew that I didn't have like a ton of power. I could run well. I wasn't really super skilled defensively, but I could play a bunch of different positions. And so I figured, you know what, if I'm going to get to the major leagues, I better do something extraordinary. And I don't have anything that I can physically do extraordinarily well other than maybe run a little bit. So I better be able to hit. And so I studied hitting a lot and did a lot of work with that. And I remember reading, you know, all types of hitting books, like Ted Williams' book and Wade Boggs' book and all different excerpts and people talking about it, and just sucked up a lot of information and worked on some of the things that really would help me be as good as I could possibly be. And I was a pretty good hitter. I was actually a really good minor league hitter and made myself, you know, pretty damn competent with making contact and ended up, I think that was the reason. I mean, I was a late round pick. I was like 11th rounder. I was a 10th pick, I think, that year, but I was 11th rounder. And it wasn't like they invested a ton of money in me or anything like that. But But I knew that I had to make my mark by throwing up numbers and heavy numbers every year. So one, I remember Bill Bavese was the director of the minor leagues before he became the GM. And I remember like 1 year after having a pretty decent year in A-ball, my first long season A-ball in Palm Springs, I remember saying, hey, you know what? You walked a lot, you did a lot of this, but you didn't drive the ball enough power, not enough doubles, not enough. Okay, all right, so I got to get stronger. So I got stronger that offseason, and I had like the next year, I think I had more doubles than anybody in our organization. So I try to make myself indispensable in a way that at least they would have to like look at me and say, hey, this guy's not too bad, you know, yeah. Maybe we can move him to the next level, see how he does. And so I was fortunate enough to be able to play in some pretty good offensive leagues in the Texas League. I put, some of those numbers are pretty inflated. And then in the, but you got to do it too, right?
Right.
It's like saying, oh, you got to do it. We're not playing very good teams. Well, guess what? You got to beat those teams too.
Exactly.
So, I did have some success there, and unfortunately, I didn't carry it too far in major leagues, but. But it was, but it certainly helped get me there and get me noticed, and I was really lucky, very fortunate.
Do you remember the minor leagues as do you have fond memories of the minor leagues? Because it's hit or miss with guys; they either hated it or they loved it.
I had a love hate for it. I mean, I'll try to explain it this way. I mean, when you're first playing in the lower minor leagues, you're like really, really happy just to get an opportunity to play professional baseball. You're not getting paid squat. I mean, I made $750 a month and I only played or $700 a month. My first year, I only played a month and 2 months. And then the next year I got a raise to $750. I was the MVP of the team. I got a raise to $750. I was playing in Palm Springs. Like, how is $750 a month going to make it to fall through Palm Springs?
Yeah.
So four of us lived together, and I played with a guy named John Orton, who was a first rounder, was a catcher he got to the big leagues with the Angels, who was pretty talented, but it just couldn't hit enough. A guy named Mark Baca is now a scout, I think, with the Washington Nationals for a long, long time. He got to like Double A. Reed Peters is now he's a head coach at U.S. Air Force Academy now. And myself, the four of us lived together in Palm Springs. We played a lot of hacky sack. We just played baseball. And that was a blast. I got to tell you that might have been the greatest spring and summer I've ever had, was the spring and summer of Palm Springs in 1988. And I ended up getting to the Double A for a short period of time. Somebody got hurt. And I happened to be hot at the time. I got up to the Double A for a minute while they were in the playoff run, and then got sent back. But we ended up winning, you know, the first half. I think we played in the playoffs, and then we just built, like, it was fun. We built a nice camaraderie. Now, as you get closer and you're getting closer, now you start thinking about long term. Like, dude, am I going to be a major leaguer? And you start thinking. You start thinking a little bit more individualistically about what you need to do in your career to get there. And I still have great fond memories of playing in Midland, Texas and AAA. And I still have in Edmonton, and I still have great friends. Gary DeSarcina is still a close friend. I got to coach with him. Paul Sorrento, who I played with in A-ball, is a close friend. He's now a hitting coach with the California Angels. Joe Madden was our field coordinator. So I have a great relationship with Joe and known him for many, many, many years. Over the years, you get to know people and still have, you know, still have friendships and bonds. But it does become difficult, because then you get a little edgy, because you're putting up numbers and you're doing things. And why am I not getting a call to the major leagues? And how come I'm not? And then you get a call, and I got to the big leagues, and then I didn't get in a bat. I think, I don't even know if I got an official at bat. Got sent back down. I was like, I hate this game. You know, I can't, you know, you go from heaven to hell in about 2 seconds. Right. And then you start, then things become a little different as far as your outlook, you know. Now you're thinking about long-term career. Like, man, I got to figure out how to be a major leaguer. Yeah. I got to, because I'm not making any money doing this in the minor leagues. And so, So then it becomes a little different when you're bouncing back and forth, but you know, you still got to love it. You still got to hang in there and you still got to grind it out unless you happen to be over talented, like some of these guys are, and they get to the big leagues and they can make it and then move on. That doesn't happen all that often, but it, you know, not everybody right. goes in the straight line.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's something that folks maybe don't understand, that there are very few guys that are kind of just like destined for the big leagues. They're going to get there. They know they're going to stay there. They're going to make the big money. And, you know, the rest of you guys, it's work, and it's a hard work, and there's stress involved, and you get there and then it's trying to stay there. And, you know, yeah. you got the young kid coming up behind you. It's all of that.
You're absolutely right. I mean, there's very few Ken Griffey Jr. So I got a chance yes. to play against him and watched him. And I remember calling my buddy Dave Esker and going, I just saw like a Hall of Famer, dude. This kid's 17 years old and he could do more things than I've ever seen anybody in the world.
Right.
But you know, the Mike Trouts and the Ken Griffey Jr.'s of the world who get to the major leagues and have success, it just doesn't happen all that often.
No, it really doesn't. It really doesn't. All right. So you mentioned it. You make your debut on June 8th, 1991. I think if I was reading the box score right, you got in the ninth inning as a defensive replacement, I think, because you did not get an official at bat in that game.
Right. So I came in as a pinch runner for, if I remember right, and I think I do, I come in as a pinch. My first appearance is I'm as a pinch runner, and I literally can't feel my feet when I run onto the field.
I bet.
And I was generally a good base runner who could steal some bases, and we were down a run. Dave Parker hits a bullet off the right field wall and can only get a single out of it. Here I come to go pinch run for Dave Parker. They bunt me over. I slide into second base. I almost slide past the bag. I'm so excited. Almost slide off the bag to grab the bag. Yeah, exactly. I'm like, oh my God, the dirt's different here, man. I usually stop here in the big leagues. The dirt. Yeah.
I didn't hit a rock, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And then we ended up getting, like, somebody hit a humpback line drive and I couldn't score. So I was first and third. And then somebody hit a double play ball. Oh, it was Max Venable hit a bullet for a double play ball to end the game. We end up losing. And, you know, 2 days later I got sent out. So,
yeah. 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 And there you go. And there's that's the heartache because right. you don't come back again until September 19th. And you come back up, as part of, I'm guessing as roster expanded and that kind of thing. But on yes. September 22nd, then it happens for you, right? Now, what's your memory of your first big league hit? Because Roberto Hernandez was on the mound, right?
That's right.
Take us through that.
Yeah, so I had not, I mean, it had been obviously a long time coming. I think my first couple of at-bats, I think I walked and I couldn't, you know, I hadn't registered, and then I made a couple of outs, and then I got a start against the White Sox, and I'm playing, and Roberto Hernandez is throwing 100 miles an hour with a lead pipe cutter. I've never seen a cutter before in my life, and I had hit a couple of balls really good early in the game. I was hitting right-handed against a guy named Greg Hibbert, left-hander, kind of soft tosser, and Ozzie Guillen made three unbelievable plays against me, and I'm going, like, three balls that in the minor leagues were base hits. I'm going, oh my God, I'm going to get my first thrown out. Yeah. Thrown out again, and then in my last at bat, I'm facing Roberto, and Roberto throws me a cutter about 95 miles an hour, and it hits off my hand, and it bloops just out of the reach of Ozzie Guillen, and Ozzie picks it up and then tosses it into our dugout, my first hit.
How about that? That's cool. Yeah, that's cool because, again, that's baseball. You hit three on the screws and you're out, and then you hit the one off the handle and find some real estate. And next thing you know, you're a big leaguer with a base hit.
That's right.
Yeah. Cool moments. I knew we were going to do this because I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I want to get to 93 quickly just because we've had so many of the 93 guys come through on the podcast this year. It's always fun to hear the stories. You know, you're a relatively young guy on that team, coming in the middle of the season, but you're back in Philadelphia. Well, you were in Philly, but you're there in Philly. So I imagine there's a comfort level at one hand, but being around those guys, what was it like for you?
So great. So the great story about this is in 92, I was a rookie and, you know, Lenny Dykstra gets hurt and I end up playing a lot and I really struggle, but they don't really have anybody else to go to for most of the year. And I finally got to the point where I just wasn't playing well enough. They send me out. It was almost like a godsend for me. And then I come back at the end of the year. So I didn't, make the greatest impression my first month. Well, first week I was like on fire, but then I really struggled through the middle of the season. At the end of the season, when I got called back up, I think it was sometime in August, I think I got recalled in 92. We had a terrible team. We didn't play very well. I had a tough time. Like I wasn't one of the guys. Like I had to, you know, I had to bide my time. I was a rookie. Yeah. And back then, you know, it was Darren Dalton and it was Krucky and there were some veterans there. And, you know, you had to pay your dues and was not one of the boys by any stretch of the imagination and probably used my mouth probably a little bit too much. And they were like, dude, beat it. But in 93, there was a totally different feeling for me personally, just because the team was winning. And when I got an opportunity to get back, I was sent down to the minor leagues at the outset of the season because they had signed so many very good players. They had Eisenreich and Milt Thompson and Pete Incaviglia in the outfield and Wes Chamberlain and the dude was, you know, Lenny was healthy. So I was odd man out. So I started off the season in the minor leagues and then I asked Wes Chamberlain got hurt and I finally got recalled. And it was a totally different feeling in the clubhouse. It was not only was I respected more because I think that I'd gone through the whole clubhouse thing, but I think I matured also a little bit as a player. And I think I was accepted a lot better. And I became kind of a role player for the team. As you probably remember, there was three platoons. We had the platoon in left, a platoon in right, and then a platoon at second base. And when Wes Chamberlain got hurt, I started playing against the left-handers when Eisenreich didn't play in right field. They had Milt Thompson and Incaviglia in left, and then they had Mariano Duncan and Mickey Morandini at second base. And so I got opportunities to play. And when I played, I played well. And, you know, I would get a bunt down. I could do some of the little things, pinch run, pinch hit, do some of the little things to contribute to some of the wins. And I think I gained a lot more credibility with the guys in the corner, yeah. With the big boys in the corner in the locker room. And I would be remiss if I didn't say at one point I remembered of all people, and I didn't know if I liked this guy that much at the time, but I remember John Kruk coming up to me and saying, "Listen, man, at some point you got to stop looking over your shoulder and worrying about, and just go play. You just got to go play." And I remember those words because they were very poignant for me. I've told John since then. I mean, they meant a lot. Because he knew I was struggling mentally to like get over the hump because it'd been a long time since I struggled. I was like, oh my God. And for him to say that, and then when, you know, I started gaining a lot more credibility with your peers, when they ended up making the roster for the playoffs, I was taken off the roster and they brought Tony Longmire and added him to the roster. He was a young player who was a pretty good left-handed hitter. Probably a better left-handed hitter than me, probably more of a home run threat. But I felt that I earned my colors, so to speak, and felt like I was like the right guy. And when the players came out publicly and said to me and publicly that I kind of got screwed there, that's when I felt like, oh my God, I think I've made it as a major leaguer. Because anytime you gain your credibility from your peers, that's way more important than anybody else. Yep. Your family, your friends, the fans. When you gain credibility from your teammates,
right,
and the veteran teammates, that's when you feel like you've accomplished something. You feel a lot more comfortable. And that was what was so cool for me at the end of that 93 season.
Yeah, and that is cool. And, you know, if there was one thing about that team that they respected was playing the game hard and playing the game right. And if you're getting bunts down and you're taking extra bases and you're doing those things, those guys, as crazy of a bunch as they were, in between the lines. That's all that mattered to them. And if you're doing that, you were part of that. You were part of them. That makes a lot of sense that they recognize that. And, you know, we know John very well, John Kruk. And I mean, you know, I've gotten to know a lot of those guys over the years from that team. And they all had that persona inside that clubhouse. I covered that team. I was a freshman reporter coming into that clubhouse right out of college, and it was a very difficult room to be a part of, but we know them so differently now, and it doesn't surprise me to hear something like that. John would never have wanted that public at back then, but he knew how it was for you to hear.
Very, very cool moment for me, and I'll never forget it. It was important, you know, and something that I remembered, and it's also something I remember having a conversation with guys like Kevin Stocker and Lieberthal when I was playing in AAA with them during that year. I'm like, hey, guys, listen, you're going to be needed at some point. Just relax and go play the game. It's going to happen for you guys. And sure enough, Kevin Stocker gets called up and he hits like 330. I mean, he was hitting like 120 in AAA, and he was like distraught. I'm like, dude, they want you for your glove. You need to just catch the baseball. Don't worry about all the BS that's going on, because at some point you're going to get a call up. And sure enough, he gets called up to the big. Same thing with Levy. I mean, I remember having, you know, Levy's worried about his numbers and, oh my God, I'm like, dude, you'll be in the big leagues. Just relax, play the game. And I just remember having those same sort of conversations with guys, just because I knew it had, you know, such a different impact with me.
Yeah, it's awesome. All right, but I got one more question before I let you go, because I got to touch on your days in the front office. Your playing career ends, and you immediately join the Phillies front office. Ed Wade, who is still around today. I just saw him on Sunday, as a matter of fact. Yeah. He was at the game. You join the front office, and, you know, it makes a lot of sense. A young man who's been around the game, Stanford education, you know, perfect fit for you and the Phillies organization. And then, you know, obviously we win in 08 with Pat, and then you take over the reins, and there's so much more to talk about, but just give me one moment when you're in the room and you're making the decisions. I mean, there's some big trades that happen over the next couple of years. You bring in some outstanding players into the organization. Is there a moment that you think back and you think, wow, you know, you're looking around and, you know, you just hung up with another GM, you know, this is happening, and you say to yourself, oh my gosh, just pinch me at this point, right?
Yeah, I have to say, it had to be the Cliff Lee trade at the trade deadline, because I mean, it had such amazing immediate impact. I mean, my first trade was one of them. I think I traded Golson for John Mayberry Jr. There was two first rounders that really had not worked out very well for either team. Golston for us and John Mayberry Jr. I think for the Texas Rangers.
Yeah.
And although he may have been traded twice. Anyway, so we flip-flopped. That was like my very first trade. I was nervous. I was like, oh my God. I mean, what's gonna happen? I figured, you know what? And then, you know, John Mayberry ended up being, you know,
pretty good.
Had some impact on our club. So it ended, you know, he didn't end up being a championship player, but he ended up having some impact on us and did contribute to the organization. But the Cliff Lee trade for me was when I had gone through obviously as an assistant for 10 years under Pat and under Ed Wade, that you know, you witness, watch guys work, and you see how they, you know, they see how they, you know, manipulate, and you see how they work things and such. And I just try to take as much information from all those guys, because they're really good at what they did.
Yes.
And I was so fortunate to work for both of them. And just try to be myself. And I was lucky to have a really supportive, some great people in baseball. I had Dallas Green with me at my one side. I had Pat Gillick was still one of my advisors. I had guys like Scott Profrock and, you know, Charlie Kerfeld and Mike Ondo, who was a great help to us, is now still with the organization as the pro scouting director. Just a lot of good people around. Gordon Lakey, who was a longtime scout, professional scout, and was excellent at what he did. And just to have that experience around me really helped me to make that decision. Ultimately, it falls on me, but but it really is a group effort. It's really about making decisions as a group. And I always believed in that. And, you know, I was dead set on trying to get Roy Halladay. He was my guy. And we ended up, you know, checking off and getting, making a deal that was probably more advantageous for us at the time based on who we gave up. By getting Cliff Lee, and he just pitched lights out. I mean, he was phenomenal. Yeah. And so in a lot of ways, you know, you're very, very nervous about making that big, big deal. But having done that and then getting kind of like, I remember walking into either Arizona or San Diego's clubhouse when we made the deal and like had the players like give me a standing O when I walked into the, that was, of all the things that happened in my career, as far as me being like humbled and proud, for the players to react like that, I was like, oh my God, yeah. this is really badass. This is cool.
Yeah.
Now it's
yeah.
quite a moment. That was yeah. quite a moment.
Oh man. It sounds like it. Okay. I'm going to be true to my word. I'm going to wrap this up, but just tell everybody out there right now that being a broadcaster is much tougher than being a GM and being a ball player.
It's the most difficult thing yeah. I've ever done in my life. Literally hours and hours and hours of preparation.
Yeah. I just needed I'm everyone. Very nervous. anyone could play the game. Come on.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll tell you, I've gained a great deal of respect for the people that are behind the mic these days because it is not easy. It is a hard job. And the fact that, you know, we have a team of people who are doing that here in Philadelphia that are, as far as people are concerned,
yeah.
tremendous people. You included, but it's been a cool family to be a part of, and I'm glad they've kind of taken me in. They haven't shut down and thrown me to the side quite yet as a rookie.
But it's hey, you know what? You've certainly earned your stripes and have added an awful lot over the last year and a half to the broadcast, and you know. It's just another thing that you add to that very, very impressive resume of yours in this game. We didn't talk about like three other things that you've done, but that's yeah. okay. Ruben, I really appreciate you stopping by and sharing your stories. They're great stories. And, you know, it's been a lot of fun for you, I'm sure, over the years growing up in the game of baseball. But like I said at the beginning, I feel like there's so much more for you in this game. Who knows what comes next for you? We'll see. I guess that's the fun of it, right?
Yeah, no, I'm really enjoying what I'm doing now. If I get to do it for the next, you know, 20 years or 30 years or until I croak, I mean, I'll tell you, I've been very fortunate to be able to be around you guys and to be able to bring, you know, baseball to Philadelphia still.
Still, right back at the beginning. Yeah. All right, Ruben Amaro Jr. joining us today here on Glove Stories with Murph. We'll take a quick timeout and be back with more right after this. Hey, everyone, Murph here, and the Parx Sportsbook app is the official sportsbook partner of the real Philly sports fan. Bet on it all, baseball, golf, MMA, and more. Live in-game play-by-play betting lets you bet while you watch. No better way to bet right now than the Parx Sportsbook app. The only sportsbook app backed by the number one casino in Pennsylvania and the only one I recommend. No one does live in-game play-by-play betting better. Bet the money line as it changes during the game on the Parx Sportsbook app. Plus, bet on individual player performances. In baseball, you can bet on hits, home runs, and pitcher strikeouts every inning. How about golf? You can bet on match winners, bet on leaders after rounds, and more. New customers sign up right now and get your first bet risk-free up to $500. Just download the app or click parxcasino.com/PA and use promo code ACTION. Do it now. Your first bet risk-free up to $500. Just download the app or click parxcasino.com/PA and use that promo code ACTION. The website has all the details. Get game previews, podcasts, and more on Twitter at Parx Sportsbook. You must be 21 and in Pennsylvania. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Glove Stories with Murph is brought to you by Red Robin. Whether you're hungry for a juicy gourmet burger with bottomless steak fries and an ice cold beer, or a crispy chicken tender salad and freckled lemonade, whatever you crave, there's something for everyone at Red Robin. So dine in or order curbside to go, delivery or catering. Order online now at order.redrobinpa.com.
Hey,
And welcome back to Glove Stories with Murph, and the time on the podcast where we revisit one of those championship games from the championship season of 1980. And to help us do that, as always, Larry Boa joins us to talk about this particular game. Now, Larry, when last we spoke, we had the team was flying back from a West Coast trip where they went 4-3. On the West Coast trip, they beat the Giants three times. You beat the Dodgers once, but then lost three straight. Came back to Philadelphia, half game back behind the Montreal Expos. But you were ahead of the Pirates, and that's who was there in Philadelphia waiting for you, a two-game series with the Pirates. What are your thoughts about you guys were coming home from losing three straight? It was a winning road trip, but you had lost three straight. Where was the mindset of the team right then?
Well, the first thing first is we knew we had the big guy going when we got off the plane.
Yeah.
And anytime Carlton was going to pitch, we knew we had a good chance to win it. But on the other hand, it didn't matter if we were in last place, first place, third place, playing the Pirates. You didn't have to do anything to get up for them. It was just a natural rivalry. They hated us. We hated them. So, and we knew that the fans were going to be rocking the vet because we were in this thing. And, all summer, you guys better win this year. You guys better win. We're going to break up the team. And we felt all that pressure all year. We didn't play consistently, but we started to put things together, and it started with this game against the Pirates. And it was another good game that we needed to win, and the big guy came through for us. There's no question about that.
He did. He did in unconventional Steve Carlton fashion, and we'll talk about that. But 43,333 at the vet for game one of this Pittsburgh Pirates series. If you're listening and lucky enough to remember Veterans Stadium, when you put 40,000 plus in that place, it rocked like no other ballpark, right?
It was really loud that whole month of September, every time we played a home game, and then eventually into the playoffs. But the other thing, every time we've done one of these and we've played the Pirates, I always look at the bottom where it says hit by pitches. Somebody's always getting hit. I don't know if they were on purpose, but there's always a hit by pitch by both teams. And again, the two guys got hit in this game. But it's just a rivalry, Murph, that the fans were up for it. I mean, you got a lot of people from Pittsburgh that came to watch this game.
Sure.
And when we went to Pittsburgh, we had a lot of Philly people go to those games. So the rivalry was real. It's not like that anymore because you only play them once here and once in Pittsburgh. But back then we played each other a lot and it was real.
Yeah. Yeah. And they had, and in 79, they took the division from you guys. So, there was a little bit of that as well, little paybacks after you guys had been riding up top. All right. Well, it would be the Pirates who would get on the board first in the top of the second. Bill Robinson would lead off with a single. Lee Lacy doubled to left, then back to back sacrifice flies gave the Pirates a 2-0 lead early on. Carlton on the mound, that's odd for sure. Was he one of those superstar pitchers that if you got to him early, that's about the only way you're going to beat him?
If you are going to get to him, Murph, which not too many people did, but when you did, you had to get him in the first three or four innings. Remembering that game, his command wasn't real good. But you know what? If you don't get him, you kick him down to one knee and he gets back up, you might as well forget it because he fights to the end. And if I'm not mistaken, he gave us a lot of length that game.
He did.
Even though he started off, they could throw 7 or 8 innings. And even though he started off a little slow, he did what he was supposed to do. He kept us right there. And that really helped our ball club because we had to go to the bullpen. I think we used 2 or 3 relievers. And if I'm not mistaken, Pittsburgh used a bunch of relievers. They went through their whole bullpen.
I think they used 5 or 6 guys out of the pen that night.
Right.
You're right. All right. Well, you guys did what you needed to do. You come right back in the bottom of the second facing John Candelaria. Luzinski led off with a single. Trio grounded out. Maddox doubled to put runners at second and third. Then you hit a sacrifice fly, get the first run in. Then Bob Boone doubled, tied the game at 2. So bang, you get Carlton the runs right back. And that's what you want to do for your A's, right?
Yeah. Once we got back in that game right away, because Candelaria was tough.
Yeah,
I mean, he had that unorthodox, he sort of slung the ball, but he threw very hard, 6'5". They had everybody on that team was like 6'5", 6'6", and they threw hard and they were mean, obviously. they didn't care if they hit anybody. But we knew it was going to be a tough game with him on the mound before we even took the field. And it was good to get back in the game right away. Because if you give a guy like Candelaria enough runs early, he's going to put you away. But we bounced back and got right back in the ball game.
Yeah. just like that. And that's good baseball. All right. So both pitchers at that point, they settle down and you get to the top of the seventh. And then the Pirates start chipping away again. Lee Lacy leads off with an inning with a triple. Phil Garner hit a double, scoring Lacy. Carlton then got Steve Nicosia and John Candelaria out before Omar Moreno would single. And all of a sudden, that two-run lead is back. It's 4-2 Pirates. What I find interesting, because in nowadays, you know, Carlton doesn't make it through that inning. No way he makes it through that inning. But Dallas stayed with him.
Yeah, well, Dallas is going to ride the horse. There's no question. And that's the one thing that's different in the game played today and back when we played. Is if your ace was out there and, you know, he was battling, you're going to stay with him.
Yeah.
Even though we had a good bullpen, Dallas Green respected what Carlton did. He left him in. It might have been too long. There's no question. But first of all, if you're going to take him out, you better signal before you go to the mound and ask him, because I've been on that mound where Danny Ozark, you say, you all right? He goes, yeah, what do you think? I'm good. Leave me alone. Stuff right. like that. So Dallas, he didn't even bother, and he left him in. And, you know, at the time, it didn't look very good, but we bounced back once again.
Yes, you did. The score was 4-2 to the bottom of the eighth, working against the Pirates bullpen now. Keith Moreland would come in. He would double. Lonnie Smith struck out. Pete Rose grounded out. And in came your old buddy Kent Tekulve to try and finish things up for the Pirates. And Schmitty, right out of the first batter he faces, triples to score a run. Then Lozinski singles to score Schmidt. Boom. Game tied at 4. You guys had Tekulve's number a little bit, didn't you?
We did. But the two guys you just mentioned, they didn't. They might have been successful hitting off him. But, you know, when you talk in the clubhouse, they didn't like facing him. You know, the submariner slinging the ball, right-handed on right-handed. And to see them come up with two big hits against Tekulve at that time was huge, because usually when Tekulve comes in, there's ground balls and he gets the job done. But those two big guys came up big for us, and that was huge. And the crowd was going crazy. I remember bet. That.
Yep.
And, you know, it, obviously the game went into extra innings then.
Yeah, now and deep into extra innings as well. No ghost runner on second base in the 10th inning in this one. And both bullpens would pitch well. Dickie Knowles, 2 scoreless innings. Then Ron Reed with 2 scoreless innings as well. And in the 14th inning, Phil's offense facing Mark Lee. Gary Maddox would double the lead off the inning. Always a good sign. There, here's your ghost runner on second. That's how you started off with the runner on second.
Right.
You double. And then you hit a ground ball to the right side, doing the right thing. You move Maddox over to third. Bob Boone sacrifice bunt. He lays down a bunt to score the winning run. Is that how that ended?
Yeah, it put down sacrifice bunt, but it was a squeeze play. It was almost like, and Dallas wasn't afraid to do that. You know, the bottom of our order with Booney and myself, we always had a lot of situation hitting, and if it meant getting the ball to the right side, that's how we played the game, because we knew the guys in the middle and at the top were going to do their job. And, you know, when you hit down the bottom in a good lineup, you better do your job. And, you know, I hit a lot of ground balls after guys doubled the ground ball to second base or first base, and then Booney would do the rest. And he was very productive down there, but that was a squeeze. I don't remember if it was a suicide or a safety squeeze, because Maddox could really, really run.
Yes.
And I think it was such a bad bunt. I think it was a suicide squeeze. That's why I think they gave him a sacrifice, because it wasn't – I don't think they gave him a base hit on it. But
no,
Maddox, everything was perfect, and that's how we end up winning the ball game.
I love it. What a great way to win. Now I can imagine what that crowd must have been like, because I bet you the 44-plus were still hanging around in the 14th inning.
You know, Murph, I was going to say something about that. When we had extra inning games, you know, I go to a lot of games now at Citizens Bank, and usually in the last, if it goes into extra inning, people will stay to watch Harper hit, and then everybody leaves. They don't want to have the traffic. But in our games, when we had extra inning games, nobody left. And I guess, obviously, it was we were fighting for Bennett.
Right.
And hopefully that'll happen this year with our ball club going down the stretch here. But this was the start of something big. We were running out of games, and we knew it. And we had to start playing real good baseball going down the stretch, because those other two teams, you're talking about Pittsburgh and Montreal, had good baseball teams.
They really did. But this might have been one of the final nails in the coffin for the Pirates. You guys move a half game out of first place behind Montreal, and now 3.5 games ahead of the Pirates, who were starting to fade at that point. And you certainly helped them along by winning this game. You would sweep the Pirates and the Mets, and you would win 4 straight. Still a half game behind Montreal, because they kept on winning as well. You would then drop a doubleheader the next day to St. Louis, and all of a sudden, two games back with 21 games to play. That's where you sat. It's hard to believe.
That didn't look good, Murph.
No.
I mean, we knew it, too. When we lost the doubleheader, you know, I mean, you sit around the clubhouse, you go, man, that was tough. Yeah. But, you know, it turned out good, as we all know. But to lose two games then was very crucial part of the season. And we knew that our backs were against the wall. There's no question about that.
Yeah, exactly. 3 weeks of baseball left, and you needed to catch those Montreal Expos down too. So that's what we've got. We've got a couple more games to revisit before we get to the postseason, and we'll do that coming up later on A Glove Stories with Murph a little bit down the road. But right now, Larry Boa joining us, as always. Thanks so much. Good to talk to you.
All right, Murph, this is getting exciting. I can hardly wait for the next ones. Okay.
Glove Stories with Murph is brought to you by Red Robin. Whether you're hungry for a juicy gourmet burger with bottomless steak fries and an ice cold beer, or a crispy chicken tender salad and freckled lemonade, whatever you crave, there's something for everyone at Red Robin. So dine in or order curbside to go, delivery or catering. Order online now at order.redrobinpa.com. Glove Stories with Murph is presented by Parx Casino Sportsbook app. New users download an app store or click parxcasino.com/PA and use the promo code MONEY for first bet risk-free up to $500. Must be 21. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Glove Stories with Murph is presented by Parx Casino Sportsbook app and Red Robin and is a production of SBC Media Partners. The engineer for Glove Stories is Chad Evans. Cindy Webster is our marketing and guest relations director, and our executive producer is Roger Haddon. Whether you are watching us on YouTube or downloading the podcast from one of our major podcast providers like Apple, Google, or Spotify, make sure to hit like and subscribe so that we can let you know when a new episode of Glove Stories is available. We'll release new episodes weekly throughout the 2021 Major League Baseball season.